On this, our 129th anniversary, we go all the way back to 2016 and our interview with retired International Representative Mike Nugent, something he said about our founder, Henry Miller.
So I was working late one night, as I did a lot of times, trying to organize things because it was nice and quiet. And my hands fell upon a copy of the first constitution of the IBEW. So I opened it up, and I had never opened it up before. So I opened it up, and on the inside cover of the constitution were a list of officers and their addresses. And lo and behold, there was Henry Miller and his address. And I was stunned because Miller was like a huge black hole. Nobody knew much about him other than what Kelly had written about him, and one of the travelers had written about him after his death. Very little bio.
Mike was dead on. For many of us, Henry remains an enigma, despite the images on all the t-shirts. Outside of J.T. Kelly's effort to document our history, Henry remains, for all intents and purposes, a ghost. Buried in the record under a seemingly endless sea of Henry Millers, from a Shakespearean actor to a popular piano brand, chasing our founder through history is a daunting task. But we soldier on, following every fork in the road, filling our labor history folder and placing our hope in serendipity. Charles Castle was the focus of one of those wishful expeditions, the man who, in the words of Curtis Bateman, helped Henry gain his footing in unionism. We know they intersected. Was there more to discover about the events surrounding that fateful September of 1890? If we chased Castle, would we find Miller? The answer was no. Again, Henry was missing, probably riding a bumper on his way to charter another local union. But what we did find was fascinating. A man whose dedication to his fellow workmen was reminiscent of the values that have endeared generations of IBEW members to our Henry. We know the story well, thanks to this line from our late brother and president, Ed Hill.
An organizer later met with the group at Stoley's Hall. It was there that the first St. Louis Electricians Union, AFL, Federal Labor Union number 5221, was formed.
But Castle wasn't just any organizer. His work at the dawn of our movement preceded the American Federation of Labor. He was a key player in a powerful city central, the St. Louis Trades Assembly, who, along with other city centrals, would eventually cede their power for the greater good to help form the American Federation of Labor in 1886. The following segment from the Gompers Papers sums it up. The St. Louis Trades Assembly was organized in 1878 and participated in the formation of the FOTLU in 1881 and the American Federation of Labor in 1886. In 1887, the Trades Assembly merged with the Central Labor Union to form the St. Louis Trades and Labor Union. And when the St. Louis Republican newspaper shared news of a gathering on the eve of Working Man's Day in 1879, they included two addresses from representatives of the St. Louis Trades Assembly, one from the chairman of the organizing committee, Charles Castle, and one from the president, Peter J. McGuire. A full 11 years before Castle would facilitate 5221's charter, he stood on a dais alongside the man who would become the first secretary of the AFL. Born in 1845, Castle settled in St. Louis after emigrating from Hanover, Germany. Census records list his first language as German. When I shared that discovery with Curtis Bateman's predecessor, retired International Representative Mike Nugent, he reminded me of a passage from the 1893 Electrical Worker. Grand President Miller delivered a rattling good speech, which made a great impression on the boys. Brother Miller has greatly improved his delivery since he left St. Louis a year and a half ago. He still has the same earnest and fiery manner, but has lost most of his German accent. It's fun to imagine Castle and Miller sharing a beer in Stoley's dance hall and falling back into their native tongue while the others urge them to stick with English. Castle's name first appears in the St. Louis Republican as an officer for the Cigar Makers International Union, Local 44, at the time the most powerful union in St. Louis. And Castle and his business manager, David Crayling, would both become heavily involved in the St. Louis Trades Assembly, Castle as an organizer and Crayling as president. For a time, when there was a vacancy, as Kraling later recounts in Golden Jubilee Recollections, a historical summary he penned for their 50th anniversary in 1937, volunteer members of the Trades Assembly often traded the position of president. And sure enough, the papers carried brief periods where Castle would step in as president. To help us frame Castle's story and provide some insight into the Scarmaker's impact on the early American trade union movement, we reached out to the University of Maryland's Ben Blake, archivist for the George Meany Labor Archives. Ben offers a brief summary of the life of a cigar maker in the 19th century and the deplorable conditions that motivated them to unionize.
Well, I did work on piecing together some of the history of the cigar makers. We do have the official records of the union here at the archives. It is on microfilm. The original paper records were not saved. And we got them here at Maryland way back in 1970s. So it's kind of hard, you know, going through the microfilm, but those are the kind of things hopefully in the future we'll be able to digitize and make them searchable. But the cigar makers are, it's really interesting. Of course, the first founding president of the American Federation of Labor was a cigar maker, you know, Samuel Gompers. So it seems like the cigar makers had a big influence on the founding of, you know, what's now, you know, the modern labor movement in the 1880s. And I think it seems like the reason that union was so strong in the cigar industry was it's very similar to kind of the garment industry and where originally you had this what they called a turn-in system that was before the Civil War. Of course, cigars back then were all made by hand. So this turn-in system, basically, these brokers would sell the cigar makers kind of at double the price or more, inflated prices. They'd sell them the tobacco, and they'd go home and roll the tobacco, roll the cigars, and then bring them back to the brokers. And, of course, the brokers could reject them or, you know, give them about any price they wanted. So it was a piece rate system, and they had to do all the work at home. So that's, you know, I can imagine would be pretty terrible conditions, you know, long hours, low piece rates. And then after, during the Civil War, the government kind of came in and started regulating it. They developed, but it really didn't in a lot of ways help so much. The government required that there actually be kind of bonded employers, probably as a safety issue. And I'm sure in the Civil War, you know, the demand for cigars, I'm sure, went through the roof, particularly, you know, people like General Grant, you know, smoking the cigar. He's pretty famous for that in all the photos of him. And so there was what developed was called a tenement system after the Civil War. So literally, an employer would rent out a whole section of tenements in a city and import immigrant workers at low wages, and then their whole family would be making the cigars in these tenements. So it's like company housing, and with the whole family making cigars again on this kind of piece rate system that, you know, kept the cigar makers in extreme poverty and their families. And the employers played off the immigrants to native-born English workers or English-speaking workers. In fact, the first known cigar strike was right close by here in Baltimore in 1851, where the English workers went on strike against the importation of German workers. But that didn't work. They lost that strike. But 3 years later, they united and fought together. And for a while, they had a local union in Baltimore. And then later, after the Civil War with the tenement system, basically union, I think, was formed to fight that and abolish that, so that instead of making the cigars at home in these tenements that were rented by the company, I'm sure it was inflated prices and things, the manufacturer would come out into actually factories where the cigars would be made by hand. And so the union was formed to do that, to kind of create a workplace and, you know, totally restructure the industry. And they were successful at that. And I think a big part of their success was there in 1867, they were one of two unions that admitted African Americans and women workers. So they had that tradition that later the Knights of Labor developed of uniting all the workforce, all the immigrants, everyone who worked in the industry. So in some ways, it was kind of a precursor to industrial organization that later came along. Even though they were very high-skilled craft workers, they had the idea, very strong idea of unity. And so they were very successful. And in 1881, they had about 10,000 members, which would have made them one of the very largest unions at the founding of the American Federation of Labor. And so I think, kind of long story short, what really prompted the organization was just, you know, poverty wages, not really having to do the work at home, having to have your whole family involved, and kind of basically trying to establish an independent life with a decent wage, independent of the employer, so they wouldn't have total control over you. So it's an amazing story.
We asked Ben to tell us more about a unique benefit won by the cigar makers after they unionized. Someone was paid to read to them during working hours.
Really, through the 19th century, all cigars were made by hand. It wasn't really until the beginning of the 20th century that machines were developed to make cigars. So this is very highly skilled trade. And basically, you would just, you know, roll the tobacco, and then the only tool you needed was a cutter to cut the tobacco leaves. And so that's one of the reasons why that employers could develop this kind of turn-in system, and then later the tenement system. But once the union was able to abolish that tenement, they call it tenement house system, and establish actual factories where the workers made the cigars. You know, it's almost like a classroom. They're lined up in benches making cigars, you know, maybe 100 workers in a factory. And at the front of the factory, there would be a desk usually, or a podium or something like that, where the cigar makers would hire someone to read to them while they're making the cigars. And it was a big deal because they might be reading, you know, pro-union literature or history of the unions, socialist literature, a variety of kind of pro-working class literature. And so it was kind of an example of the strength of the union, that they were able to win that benefit. And of course, that helped the development of the union, kind of the intellectual development of everybody in the workforce to really understand the history of unions and what unions stood for. And I'm sure, you know, they might be reading their contract to them, you know, so that they would know their rights.
Kraling's Golden Jubilee retrospective credits the St. Louis Cigar Makers Union with establishing the union label, calling St. Louis the first label city. Castle and the union label. It was an incredible claim. Here again is Ben.
I think one of the things about kind of research on like 19th century labor is it is hard to find documentation. And I've seen it referenced that the cigar makers did found the idea of union label. But I'd have to check, you know, into more detail to really verify that. But it would make sense. And there, I believe there's a museum, there's a big cigar museum that actually does a lot of research around those labels. Because, of course, those labels not only indicate a union, but also that would indicate a, you know, high-quality cigar. I think that's very likely true, that the cigar makers did found the union label movement. And I have had a chance to look at the Golden Jubilee recollections document from 1937. It's really interesting, and it's kind of an example where a lot of the great union history, you know, particularly before World War II, is generated by the unions themselves. And this is a great example of that. Like, a lot of the great majority of the documentation, because really labor history didn't get started at the University of Wisconsin, like in terms of academic labor history, until basically about the turn of the century. And it's interesting, there's a quote here at the beginning of that document from Professor Richard T. Ely, And Ely is considered one of the founders of labor history and labor archives in America. He was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. In fact, he almost got fired because he was so basically pro-labor. The students had to rally and save his job. I think it was around, it was early part of the 20th century. But there's a great story there behind his work. But he and Richard Commons founded, they published the first labor histories and did the first collecting of labor records. And he was kind of a social gospel reformist. So he kind of came from kind of a religious progressive type perspective. But he was very staunchly pro-union and was one of the great early advocates kind of in the academic community. And but the document is fantastic, and I think that that's the kind of thing that really, you know, gives you a sense for what the history was like. And again, publication date 1937, so you're talking about, you know, coming out of the Depression, you know, the big huge labor upsurge, which affected not only American Federation of Labor, but of course the founding of the Congress of Industrial Union Organizations, you know, later merged in 1955 into AFL-CIO. But you can see kind of the influence of the growing labor movement, you know, to say, okay, we need to take a look back at our history and learn those lessons of the past.
Castle was 46 years old by the time he would meet with Henry at Stolle's in September of 1890 to form Federal Local Union 5221. 2 months later, in December of 1890, the Pittsburgh Dispatch would carry news of a circular sent out by C.C. Thomas of Federal Local Union 3696, another electrical local. The circular asked all labor organizations to help organize the electrical workers of the United States and announced our intent to form a national organization at a convention soon to be held. We asked Ben about the significance of all those individual AFL Federal Local Union charters.
Yeah, and that those were chartered directly by the national AFL-CIO to, like, usually they use those charters for, like, if there wasn't enough locals and membership to do a national charter yet, so they would build up all these FLUs in, you know, maybe a trade that they didn't have a union in yet. And then those would all be merged into the national union when they got enough of them. So that was kind of a way to collect local members into locals that would later become national unions.
And that meeting at Stolle's, 15 months before our founding, Matine, Pearson, Kelly, Miller, we were struck by the diversity of the charter members of 5221.
Oh, it's just, it's to me, that's like America, you know? It's like you have people from around the world, you know, coming together, uniting to, you know, for a better life. And just having, you know, German workers in the 19th century having a beer, you know, it's like the beer hall kind of, you know, that was really the socialist culture in Germany. You know, you go to beer gardens, you go to the beer gardens, and that's where they talk union and talk politics. And they brought that culture here to the United States. And of course, the Irish workers, same thing. You know, you bring that in and, you know, you have a beer and you talk it out and you iron out, you know, how you're going to organize the union and what this means politically. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, I think the labor movement today is bringing that back. You know, we're seeing, you know, really, when I was thinking about the cigar makers, one of the things that struck me, this whole idea of the turn-in system where, you know, you make the cigar at home and then you turn into the broker and hopefully get some kind of decent pay. It just reminded me, that's like Uber. It's like the gig economy today. The other thing, whenever I think about like this Baltimore strike of the cigar makers in 1851, where the English workers are initially trying to exclude the German workers, immigrant workers, and then, you know, within a short period of time, they then decide, well, that's not working, we're going to unite. And that just reminds me of the farm workers, you know. Initially, you know, they were kind of organizing on their own. It took a while. It wasn't until 1970 that they were admitted to the AFL-CIO. And so they were kind of like proving themselves through their organization and through the grape and lettuce boycotts. And for an early on, even the farm workers were excluding immigrant workers from the union. But then they realized that didn't work, that you really, to really be able to build a union, you needed unity. And it's like the TPS workers today. You know, the labor movement now is very progressive on immigration. It's, and to me, it's the most important force, you know, trying to defend, you know, undocumented workers and, you know, all these workers that are, you know, working at very low wages, like the hotel workers or the airline workers today, you know. I know at Dulles, most of those workers are African immigrants that are, you know, just recently had the sit down. I think we're 12 were arrested. So it's kind of, you know, it just reminds me of that tradition in America of, you know, immigrant, you know, maybe initially there'd be a kind of nativist reaction against immigrants, but then that's really been being broken down. I mean, you still have that in today's society, but I think within the labor movement, it's much more of a sense of we need unity across everyone, including all the new immigrants. That's how we're really going to build a labor movement. And it's very exciting to look at the history and go, oh yeah, the same issues back in 1850s or 1880s, those same issues come up today. And a lot of times the solutions are very similar. Okay, we've got to unite, or we've got to get rid of this gig economy because nobody can make a decent living on it.
The Arbeiterverband, the local German labor coalition, would later join the St. Louis Trades Assembly. So many Germans, Samuel Gompers, Charles Castle, Henry Miller. We asked Ben about the impact of German immigrants on the labor movement in the United States.
Germans definitely played a big role in the cigar makers, as they did in a number of industries, like the bakery workers, kind of across the board. Jewish immigrants in the 19th century played a huge role in the labor movement in a whole variety of occupations and skills. And I think part of that was, of course, in Germany, you had a very strong social democratic movement and a very strong union movement, but it also was very much repressed. So a lot of the immigrants coming from Germany might have been involved in union organizing or social democratic party politics and brought very strong, you know, views and experience organizing. And I think I bet when I was looking at what little is known about that 1851 strike in Baltimore, where the English workers struck against the Germans, I'm sure that once they probably broke down the language barrier, the Germans were saying, hey, we want to join the union, you know. And then three years later, they had. And I think that there's no question that, you know, if you look at the brewery workers in Milwaukee, for example, they played a huge movement, and in Cincinnati, the German immigrants, and we have in the Carpenters Union, there were German locals in the Carpenters Union, and also in the bakery workers, we have early issues of their journal in it's in German. They had a German language edition. So I do think that the German immigrants played a tremendous role in building our labor movement.
Ben mentions German socialism. Castle would indeed run as a delegate to the Socialist Labor Party in 1878 and spoke at several socialist rallies through the 1870s and 80s, right alongside Peter J. McGuire. And Henry's first AFL convention in December of 91 is a real eye-opener. One paper, reporting on the proceedings after the first day, notes the Committee on Credentials reports unfavorably on Henry's credentials. The convention roster lists Henry as a delegate from the Linemen and Wiremen's Union No. 5221, not the National Brotherhood. Even though Gomper's letter to JT approving our national charter is dated December 8th, the opening day of the convention. We did find a notation, though unconfirmed, that an organization was required to have been in existence for at least 30 days before a delegate would have been allowed to attend. Could that be the reason Henry is listed as a delegate from the St. Louis Local Union? When Henry returns again in 1892 for the 12th AFL convention, his credentials are accepted, and the roster lists him as a delegate from the National Brotherhood. Castle is also listed on the same roster. The proceedings from Henry's first AFL convention are a fascinating read. We wondered if there were more details available at the University of Maryland.
There really is not much more than the proceedings for the 19th century. And in general, not a lot of documentation on the AFL has survived from the 19th century. And in the 1950s, the AFL microfilmed most of their historic records, and the originals were not saved. Some of them ended up anyway getting saved by the Wisconsin Historical Society, but we ended up with some of them here, but most of them were destroyed, and then they were all put onto microfilm. And so they're not, like, one of the things we're hoping to do is get all that digitized so you can search it. It's something I'm beginning to dig into. In fact, I saw we have in storage a couple boxes that are indicating that we haven't even looked at, that aren't processed or inventoried or anything, that start in 1881 that indicate convention materials. So that's something I want to – it's a high priority for me in this coming year to take a look at that and see what's in there, if it might complement kind of the basic proceedings. But those proceedings generally are very brief. We were doing research on the AFL's endorsement of women's suffrage, and I found like two sentences on it in the 1890 convention, and that was it. You know, it was like, you know, delegate so-and-so introduced the resolution around women's suffrage, and it was approved, and that was it. You know, it's no discussion. Like, there wasn't any debate on this. It's 1890. You know, this is, you know, 30 plus years before suffrage, you know. So it was a great example of the forward, you know, progressive attitude of AFL towards women, but at least in terms of kind of formal positions. But it was, there was so little there, you know. Wow. I think that is a problem, you know, that it's hard to find any kind of detailed documentation for the 19th century.
We were stunned by what happened during the 5th day's afternoon session when Henry cast his vote for August Delabar for president, one of only 4 delegates to do so, all of them socialists. And as it turns out, socialism was commonplace amongst 19th century trade unionists.
I think probably quite a few of them would have been, like, particularly the organizers and the leaders. And there was a range of different ideas about what socialism meant, you know, as in all periods of history. But, there's no question that the German immigrants brought a very strong socialist tradition. In fact, Victor Berger was, I believe he was either a German immigrant who ran for mayor and won in Milwaukee. Either his parents were German immigrants or he was, and, you know, I believe he was the first socialist mayor of a major U.S. city. And of course, then he visited Eugene Debs in prison and converted Eugene Debs to socialism. So I think that's kind of an example of the power of the German immigrants and their beliefs.
St. Louis is home to several local ones, largely due to Castle's efforts. And anyone who has ever worked as an organizer won't be surprised to know that we stumbled upon this line in the May 15, 1892 edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which stated, "Charles Castle resigned from the organizing committee, but his resignation was not accepted, and Mr. Castle was ordered to keep on, and it was agreed to pay him for his service." From early in 1870 until 1892, the dedicated Castle helped build a movement purely out of devotion. But it clearly had taken its toll. And like Henry, he is largely missing from the record. We wondered why.
See, I think that's very true. And it's that focus on organizing and, like, organizing and establishing, you know, good wages, good conditions, that a lot of the union organizers I've talked with, they're so modest and they, you know, it's like I would say, well, are you going to write an autobiography? You've done all this great work. And, you know, oh, well, you know, no, I did. It wasn't that important. I'm like, yeah, it is. It really is. And I think a lot of the organizing, even today, I was talking to a organizer who had done a lot of work around the hospital industry in Philadelphia. And I said, well, what happened to your records of all this successful organizing? And she said, well, by the end of the organizing drive, you know, we've established the union, we've been successful, and we're totally exhausted. We usually just kind of clean our office out and move on to the next campaign. And, you know, of course, for an archivist, that, you know, makes me very sad. And I have spent time, you know, rescuing records, particularly when offices consolidate, unions consolidate, we get called in. But I think what's great today with the internet and, you know, its ability now, and I think there's such a boom in kind of do-it-yourself archives and do-it-yourself history. Genealogy, of course, is booming. And I see it here is you have so many rank-and-file union members asking about, you know, what do we have on, you know, their family in the union. I just had a carpenter call up and said, you know, do you have records of my grandfather who was in the carpenter's retirement home in Florida? And so he's going to come visit when he's commuting between his house up in New England, and he's going to stop by and do research on his grandfather. And those things really build into, I think, you know, then looking at the local union or, you know, the local council, or, you know, it really a lot of times snowballs into really great stuff. A great, you know, of course, is the museum that you're working on. You know, you're doing that as a volunteer. People in the labor movement, just like organizing, the history too is there's this huge, I think, development in sort of rank and file folks and organizers at the local level building labor history, which is really exciting and something we really want to support here.
Castle married Dora Brand and took up residence at 707 Lammy Street in the Soulard neighborhood, just south of our city. After a life devoted to working people, he transitioned in May of 1923 at the age of 78. His ashes were given to his daughter, Bertha Melcher. I'd like to dedicate this show to all the devoted organizers in our movement, and one in particular, legendary organizer, our late brother, Dwayne Moore. I still remember the first time I met Dwayne in 2009. I was a young officer, and he was a force to be reckoned with. After I became an organizer in 2011, we talked often, or he did. I mostly listened. I asked Dwayne's good friend, former district organizing coordinator for the 11th District, Jeff Rose, to tell me more about him. John, he said, you just knew when you walked on a job with Dwayne, something was going to happen. To all those great men and women out there, raising the standards of working men and women all across this country, God bless you. God bless the IBEW. Happy 129th anniversary.